Hi everyone, welcome to the Blue Hoop Podcast produced by Basketball Victoria. I'm Rob Calder, the Coach Development Officer for Basketball Victoria. On the home bench, we have the High Performance Coach for Vic Metro, Mike Zeppel.
Robbie.
And on the away bench, we have the High Performance Coach for Vic Country, Justin Shaw.
3-0 this week.
Welcome guys, no one keeps score anymore. It's not about participation medals either for those keeping track. This week we've got the topic of coaching values. So this is a real broad topic, so we might touch on, you know, a dozen different things that might be of value to you. Again, if there's anything we touch on that's of interest to you in particular, you can hit us up via our email on the Basketball Victoria website. All our details are on there. So if there is something you want a little bit more information about, by all means, hit us up on that. So really broad topic to start off with. Probably the biggest thing we deal with in the game is obviously the athletes. We need to make sure that we treat these guys the right way, because as coaches, we tend to make it a little bit about us at times, which may shock some people, but coaches do have egos as well. But it really is about the players first and foremost. So what are the best things that you've seen to deal with players over your time? What's the best environment for them to learn and be productive in?
I think it's important to come from the mindset that it is a relationship-based thing. Like, I think having strong athlete-coach relationships helps drive whatever you're trying to get through, whatever goal you're trying to achieve. And what's the old saying? Like, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I think that's true to the athlete. Like, you can tell them 100 times to do something, but if they think that you're not in it for them and for the success of the team and the relationship that you have with them, if it's not that strong, there will become a point in time where they will not close out for you because they'll just do it despite you. So I think that's really important, that the athlete relationship is there.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. You know, one of my things I've always strived for, and by no means does it always happen, but provide an environment where success is inevitable. I think that's kind of our number one goal now. Success can be defined in 101 different ways, but to me, your thought process always has to be, you know, what's best for the athlete? And then if that becomes the first question every single time, then that's where those relationships grow stronger and team success does become inevitable. You know, like from what works, I just think that time spent, you know, like I've found in individual training environment is often when you build that rapport the best.
Absolutely.
And that's when you can have those conversations about what's best for that athlete, what they can bring, which helps the team success best, et cetera, et cetera. So, and just having that personal time where they know you're invested. And a massive one for me at every level is knowing them outside of the court. So making sure, you know, if they're a school-age kid, you know, you're talking to them about exam time, how they're handling that, you know, knowing that side of things. If they're a senior athlete, how's their family holding up? You know, is there any stresses with work, whatever it might be? So just making sure it's a holistic approach on that front to get the best out of, you know, the 40 minutes you need them for.
Yeah, and Justin's point there about individual attention or individual development is really important, because at the end of the day, basketball players want to become better basketball players, and they don't care about your side pick and roll defensive coverage if they don't feel like they're becoming a better basketball player. So if you can invest time into their individual development and have them feeling like they are getting better, then they'll invest more time on their own, but they'll also be invested in to everything else you have to say as well. So it's a really, really good point.
And not everything goes perfectly as coaches. Let's face it, there are times where you'll get injuries or you'll just get something going the wrong way. It's, you know, it's never perfect. So if you've got a buy-in from your players, when things do go bad, you'll at least get them checking in and trying to make things work rather than fighting against you as well, I think.
I think that's when you find out the most about how your relationship is. Like, I can kind of talk firsthand on my Seville season last year. We had injuries and illness and all sorts happened, but the group stayed the course, you know, the whole way, and just that buy-in and finding a way to do it kind of for each other. I think that sort of thing is pretty important. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're leaders, we're teachers, and we're guiding something for the greater good of everyone. So it's not... it should never be about us as individuals. It's about what can we do for the group. And I think if that's sold, that's when you're going to be able to get through those tough times.
Mm. And then the hardest thing with all that is that you might have a squad of 12 players with 12 different upbringings, family backgrounds, religions, cultures. That's where the challenge is that you have to have 12 different relationships and invest in 12 different relationships. So But that's why you coach. That's what coaching and teaching is.
But you can make that work differently as well. You might have two assistant coaches and a head coach. You can maybe divide the team up a little bit and say, hey, these three guys are yours. I'll check in with them once every fortnight or so, but you need to touch base with them once a week. I think it's a great way to do it is before training, after training, just to chat as they're warming up on the sideline. They might be shooting and getting shots up and you go rebound for them and have a chat at the same time. I think that's a great way to build a relationship between coaches and players as well.
And we live in a world now of connectivity as well. Like, you can send a mass text out to your 10 athletes with a quote, with a thought, with an encouragement, a praise, whatever it is. We live in a world of connectivity, so it's easier to do that stuff now more than ever.
The point on that I'd like to make is, with our national team, we chose not to use Messenger for that because that was, everyone's on Facebook. That's kind of a fun time. We used WhatsApp so that when they got a WhatsApp message, they knew, well, that was kind of something that was a bit more serious, was driven, focused, and that as well. So definitely technology helps us out in 1,001 different ways, but also being able to differentiate when it's real time and when it's kind of, the playtime sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. So when you start talking about sort of building your team culture, as you spoke about, Zeb, that people come from all different backgrounds and sometimes you'll have to play with people you don't necessarily like or enjoy playing with, but you are a part of a team. You need to buy in from everywhere. What are some of the things you've used over the course to try and get buy-in from all your players in the team and build a little bit of a bond? It's one of those things where if you have a resilient team, well, you can do lots of things with them. If you've got a fragile team, you can be down by 6 points and they all go to water. I mean, how do you get buy-in from all your players as a group for the greater good?
Yeah, and that's hard, mate. Because, you think about how many competitions there are, how many teams are in competitions, how many players are in teams, and there's only one team that wins at the end of the day. It's hard if you always measure yourself up against winning the championship at the end of the day as well. So culturally, that's what leadership is, like driving culture. And I think a lot of time, there's the other quote is, culture eats X's and O's for breakfast. You hear that one get thrown around as well. And a strong culture can definitely, lead you to where you want to get to. I'd be interested in what you've done in the past, having coached in the BJBL before as well. Like, have there been things you've done pre-season or during the season? You've got classic tournaments and you've got BC seasons, you've got everyone wanting to win, you've got 14 clubs. Like, what do you do through a BJBL season to kind of drive that culture?
It's really hard, I found, to keep them up for the whole year. Like, you've got to really pick and choose when you want to be good. I've never actually won BC, so I've clearly done some poor planning over the course, but it is difficult to keep everyone up for a whole year. I normally try and say, look, let's just get through grading and then we'll deal with the rest later. I don't put a lot of value in the pre-season tournament. It's just roll the balls out and go. But I've always been lucky enough to grade early. So I've had that little bit of time after Christmas.
So you said you're a bad coach, man.
Oh, I get some wins, but not enough when they matter, it turns out. But it's that period after Christmas where I really try and get the team to buy in. It's usually when you pick your team, you've got maybe 2 weeks and you're pretty much running to just try and win games as possible to try and grade. But I think the more time your team can spend with each other, the more likely you are to break down some barriers. And that might be as simple as you give the kids some surveys to go and ask questions about everyone else. What school do you go to? Which NBA team do you follow? Those sorts of things as well, just to get them talking a little bit. Because it is one of those things where kids can be introverts or extroverts. Sometimes they don't want to give up information until they're actually asked about it. So it's difficult. It can be difficult. But from a coach perspective, I need to know that information as well. If I want the kids to buy in, I need to buy in from my end as well.
Yeah, I think that's a massive point. Like, to me, culture is driven from the top, but also within. So, Dean Bickerman, I think, is known as one of the best culture-driven guys around. One of the things that I enjoy being part of his staff is, we'll work out together with the team, because if we're driving them to be of excellence at that, then so does the staff. And I think that's just an example of, if you're preaching being early to practice, don't be the guy that rocks in when everyone else is there. Like, that's driving culture from the top. The within stuff, to me, your traits need to be from the playing group. Like, we could all sit there and say, all right, this is who we're going to be and this is what we are. But if the playing group isn't coming up with that, then they aren't going to believe that when the real pressure is hitting. So massive on those parts being driven by the actual group. But again, I think everything we do as coaches drives you know, habits. You know, if we're first in, you know, and we're preaching be early to things, well, then that's going to happen. If we're taking shortcuts, well, then we can't expect the players not to take shortcuts. So that's a big thing to constantly be thinking about when we're driving that stuff.
I think all that needs to be written down as well. It's one thing to say it constantly and, you know, you can keep harping on it, but until it's written down and in front of them, I think players don't always buy into that. I think it is something they need to see all the time. And suddenly
totally
it becomes
agree.
Ingrained.
And also, like, just even if you've got your catchphrase that you use or whatnot, that only the playing group may know, but that's something that, you know, you can tag it on everything, and but then that group knows and they see that and it's like, yeah, no, actually, I need to be accountable today, or I need to make sure I'm taking care of my recovery, because for the group, that's what's best. And that stuff is pretty important. I kind of agree with Zep. I've never had a successful team that hasn't really gone along well off court and hasn't kind of gone those extra yards and the little things. Because every team on day one thinks they get a gold medal team or whatnot. It's the little things over the journey that's going to help them out.
Yeah, definitely. So assistant coaches are obviously a fairly vital part of any staff as well. They can take a lot of... I grew up with my coaching journey, I suppose, in that you need to take problems off the head coach's plate, not add to them. So whilst you may need to keep them in the loop of something that's going on, if you can solve it before it gets to the head coach, that's absolutely what you should be doing. And every head coach is going to want something a little bit different from their assistants. It might be, hey, you're only on offense, you're only on defense, we need you to take stats, we need you to coach the game or look at certain matchups and everything. What are some of the things that you value in good assistants?
Yeah, I mean, I think also empowering assistants to have
roles.
That's
a massive one.
I think that's really important. I think if you can have assistants that are bought in to particular things, that just drives that culture too, because now they can hold accountability of each other and the athletes as well. So you don't want your assistants just to be in the background, kind of just hanging out. You want them involved, engaged, a part of the planning and preparation, and have ownership of it. I think that's really important.
I'd extend that to your whole staff as well.
Yeah,
if you do have a teammate, like, empower people is pretty important, because then there's a collective buy-in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's critical. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, as a head coach, your job's also to groom the next head coach. I'm not sure you can do that without empowering and letting them also develop their own craft with you as well.
Yep. And it's all well and good, I think, as an assistant coach to constantly be dumping problems on your head coach, and they need to know a lot. They obviously need to know everything that's going on, but I've always been a believer of don't give them a problem without a solution. Here's the problem that's going on. Here's how I think you can solve it. Up to you what you do with it, because ultimately it's on the head coach.
I think there's a big part of that, but there's also a part of having an opinion.
Yeah.
So, you know, you should be able to offer maybe potentially some sort of point of difference. Now, if the head coach decides that's still not the direction, then that's okay. Yeah. But not be someone that's not actively trying to find, well, what is our point of difference? What can we do maybe a little bit different to help the cause out? Because I know as a head coach of a few teams, like, that's what I want from assistants. I want to hear some things from you know, left to centre to go, all right, well, this is going to actually potentially help. Now, at the end of the day, I may not agree, but at least there's a point of difference there with it. Unlike that, I think empowering assistants is massive. I do think defining roles is important, and that's more so you're time efficient. So if I've got, you know, two assistants and they're both working on the same stuff, that's not great. So traditionally, I'll always use someone that's working on video and one that's working on Paper Scout, and then pair up the O and the D so that when they're doing review, they're able to look at those sorts of things in more detail. But I don't think there's a right or wrong. The one thing that I hate is when you see assistant coaches that are just there and taking notes in games, like, they're coaches as well. So, you know, if you're spending your whole time hitting a book and taking stats, we get a box score, you don't need that. What we need is another set of eyes to actually see what's going on, matchup-wise, runs, anything like that.
I think it's important you have an assistant coach you can work with, because that relationship is obviously a really important one, but it's also one of those things where you don't necessarily want someone that's just going to agree with everything you say either.
Yeah.
It is, you need to hear a different point of view. Like, it's great to have an assistant coach, I think, that is on the same wavelength as you, but you also want them to challenge you at times as well, because that'll only make you a better coach.
Every great successful environment, whether that's on court or in business or anything, I think is robust discussion around decisions that are made. Now, when you leave the room, absolutely, it's one message, but you know, that staff needs to be able to discuss game plan, you know, how we're going to handle this athlete, discipline, all those things, so that everyone's on the same page and the message is consistent.
Yeah, and communication there is critical, because a part of you empowering your assistant is they now have to be able to communicate to the team, like, this is the way we're going to defend this in the half court. So for them to actually take ownership of that, be able to communicate that in a pre-game or a video meeting or whatever it is really important. And then your point to being able to have robust discussion with the head coach, absolutely. That now puts them in a position where they have to sell their argument, like, no, I think we should defend it this way. Okay, tell me how, and communicate that and be able to articulate that and sell it to me. That's that empowering process.
The one thing I think that is important, though, is your assistants have to be the positive, upbeat, like bring the energy every day, because, you know, there can only be one person having to create, you know, some detail discussion to an athlete that they don't like. So, you know, to me, it doesn't work if everyone's cracking the shits and, you know, getting down on athletes. It's more about, you know, like, all right, well, the head coach sometimes has to get on people, but everyone else is going to stay positive.
Yeah, it's a bit of that good cop, bad cop mentality as well.
Like, a little bit,
you do need a different perspective. If the coach has just chewed out a player, as an assistant coach, you want to be able to walk down the bench and pick them back up again. Yeah. They don't need to hear another negative voice. Like, they may need a bit of a reality check, but you do need to get to a point where, okay, there's the same message coming out. And as assistant coach, I think you do need to understand that ultimately it's the head coach's neck on the line. Like, it's their call. It's their team. Like, they're the one that have to answer questions if they've lost. They're the ones that ultimately have been appointed to coach that team. You're allowed an opinion as an assistant coach, but the head coach's word is final.
Last one I'd recommend for head coaches out there is have different personalities. Same goals and outcomes, because that's important. Like, everyone's agenda is the same or everyone's focus is the same, but personality-wise, I think it's really kind of good to have a few different types of people on your bench, because now the athlete, all athletes are different, so now they can gravitate to who they feel more comfortable with, and then that creates a good environment as well.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. So when we're sort of talking about scouting and things that go with that, your assistants are obviously going to be fairly heavily involved in that as well. I know, Justin, you sort of said that one will do video and one will do paper. Are you the same with that, Mike?
Yeah, or even have one solely focused on the offensive side of the ball, one focused on the defensive side of the ball. Yep. I think that's something that, if you have the resources, that can kind of help with getting a really broad picture of what you're trying to get. So there's many ways to do it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think with the scout stuff, it's really important. You do have everything written down on paper, so that when you go to the session, if you do mark something up, you've at least got it written there. If you're going through the walkthrough and you say this is a cross screen when it should actually be a down screen, you've got the notes sitting right there where you can go and do something with it as well. Like, it's a valuable part.
I think as a head coach as well, don't just go, all right, yep, assistants, you've got it, away you go. Like, you've got to be part of that process. Now, it may not be you're doing the you know, cutting of it or whatnot, but the review you need to be part of. You need to have those discussions so that when you do get into the video room, walk through, everyone is on the same page. One I'm massive on in the video room is it's only the person who's in charge of whatever's being shown, whether that's scout or review, it's their voice plus the head coach's voice. So it's not three or four different people chiming in there two or three cents worth. Like, it's got to be seamless. The athletes need to understand the staff are as one, and, you know, the voices are different. That's the way I like it.
Yep, definitely. And so when you're doing a walkthrough at a training or anything like that, who takes that walkthrough? Is that the assistant coach that's been responsible for it, or is it always the head coach?
Yeah, to me, that's part of the empowering. Well, Zip was my assistant once. I can't remember what we did then, but...
Good assistant.
Yeah. To me, that's part of it. Like, if they've spent the time drawing it up, reviewing it constantly over and over again, they're going to also go through it with the greatest detail. Like, that was my job under Mark Watkins, and I really appreciated that, especially the first campaign where you're not real at first time working, you don't really know where you fit, but that kind of gave me a responsibility, and, you know, it's something you kind of own, you want to do the best of that. So I'm a big believer that it needs to be that, but at the same time, I'm talking through how we're going to defend it. So they'll go the walkthrough, but then I'm told, well, this is how we'll defend that and go with it from there.
Yeah, no, I agree. It goes back to that empowering. Like, if you have assistants that want to do a good job and are empowered to do a good job, they'll get to the floor and be able to deliver that message for you.
Yeah, definitely. And it helps build credibility, I suppose, for the assistant coach with the playing group. A lot of the playing group can really buy into the head coach's message, and they see the assistant coaches just as two people off to the side, or whoever it may be. If they're on court more often and they're constantly talking and vocal, all of a sudden there's more buy-in from the playing group that when that message changes during a game, okay, well, now we know it's coming from the assistant, but it's just an extension of the head coach.
I think most coaches are somewhat control freaks. Well, like, I know I was really poor with delegation to assistants early on, but as head coaches got to understand, the more we delegate, the actual better we are as well. Like, there's more clarity in our head. There's not, you know, you're not confused about what you want. You're just going with the one lot of detail, and I think that's pretty important as well.
It's definitely a mistake I made early in my coaching. I wanted to take everything on myself, forgetting that I had assistants there that wanted to help and wanted to take problems away from me.
Yeah.
But it is. It's a trust exercise. If you want the players to trust the coaching staff, or as a head coach, you need to trust the assistant coaches as well. I think it's a really important part of it. So that's probably us done for this podcast. Again, any questions you've got, by all means, hit us up on the Basketball Victoria email addresses, and we'll get to them as soon as we can, and we'll speak to you guys next week.
Alrighty, got Robbie Coulter on the shot clock this week. You ready, mate?
Let's get it.
Here we go, the first team you ever coached.
The Green Hills Beavers under 12 boys.
Very good. Your favourite NBA team?
Portland Trailblazers.
And your favourite NBL team?
Illawarra Hawks.
What about in the WNBL?
Going country, going Bendigo Spirit.
Most used coaching phrase?
Does that make sense?
Does that make sense? I guess not normally. It does. What about any coaching superstitions?
Don't shave on game day.
Have you got a coach out there that you steal from?
Anything and everything from Tom Izzo.
Very good. Your favourite coaching website?
Pick and Pop, every single day.
And your favourite coaching podcast?
It has to be the Blue Hoop, but also Wally. For the second half of today's podcast, we are joined by former Australian Opal, Hannah Zavick. Thanks for joining us, Hannah.
Hi, how's it going?
Not too bad, thanks. So, for you guys that aren't aware, and I apologise in advance because I'm going to leave out a lot of stuff, this has been a hell of a career that you've had over the course. So, Wangaratta Rambouillet Jr., Australian Institute of Sport scholarship holder, former Australian Opal, graduate and Hall of Fame inductee at the University of Wyoming. That's a lot. In all honesty, like, you've done a lot in your career and still running around playing Siebel now.
Trying.
Had a pretty good year last year, I've got to admit. At this point, you've been through a lot in basketball. So your degree from Wyoming is human nutrition and food. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So you've got a pretty good understanding, I suppose, now on the life of an athlete, how they can build themselves up. So the diet and the nutrition for players is a fairly important area now. Kids are putting more and more time in on the court. Their travel commitments are probably a little bit longer than they used to be as well. And everything, it's just a life of convenience, I suppose, for a lot of athletes. So a lot of times it's, hey, what can we get? And it ends up being the fast food diet of Macca's on the way through or something like that. So what are the biggest mistakes you see athletes making when it comes to their nutrition and their diet?
I think... For myself especially, a big mistake is being an athlete, we think we can really eat whatever we want, and that doesn't always equate to the real nutritious foods. So because we're like, oh, you know, we're going to run around for 3 hours, we can eat this fast food because it's not going to make us fat, you know, but really we're not getting the best nutrition for our bodies, which is massive. It can lead to injury if we're run down and and all that type of stuff. So I think the biggest mistake is really not giving enough attention to your diet as an athlete and understanding that you need really nutritious foods that will give you the best kind of chance of having a prolonged energy throughout your training and games. So, yeah, I think that's a mistake. And another mistake is a lot of athletes kind of over-prioritise protein over other nutrients, whereas it's quite important. Like, I think the most, you know, the most needed nutrient is carbohydrate for an athlete still, and I think sometimes we just play up to protein too much when it's not in a lot of the sports that I've played anyway. It's really not a huge deal to stack up on the protein. It's just getting a nice balance of the carbs, fats, and protein. So
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose it's one of those things, you want to build a little bit of a habit with that as well. You don't want to get to a point where you've lived the life of high carbs all the way through as a player, and then all of a sudden you stop playing and you're addicted to carbs. That can really hurt you at the other end of your career, obviously, but I mean, it's a really valuable point. Everyone's on the protein shakes and they talk a lot about that, but just having a balanced diet can really help athletes out a lot, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do, you know, we work best off carbohydrates. So, and there are, you know, mostly we want to be getting complex carbohydrates, so the whole grain products and the vegetables and all that, that gives us a really great sustained energy. But there is a time for the really, for the simple sugars and for, maybe like the white bread and that straight after sport. It's not bad to have those simple sugars mixed with a protein just so it gets into our blood quicker and can help us recover. So I think also understanding what types of carbohydrates to eat.
Yep.
And knowing that, yeah, as an athlete, we can take a bit more of the simple kind of sugars, but yeah, adjusting after sport is very hard because we're used to eating a certain volume of food, and then when we're not burning it off afterwards, it can pack on the weight pretty easily.
Yeah, that's why most coaches, I find, go from looking like ex-athletes to looking like coaches fairly quickly. It's you know, it can be a massive issue. So, I mean, coaches would obviously experience fairly similar problems in that regard as well. So, I mean, how would, I suppose, the average work life for most people sort of starts around about under well, say 18 or 19. So they'll probably work all day, then go off to a training session, then probably not be getting home till sort of 9:30, 10 o'clock. And you would have experienced a fair bit of that too, just travelling from the country. How do they start planning for a life where it feels like they're constantly on the road?
Well, I think that you've just got to get really smart with getting organised with your food. So when a real big problem for people is, and where they pack on a lot of weight, is the type of snacks that they're eating. And if they're not prepared, you find yourself just grabbing something from a vending machine or from the tuck shop, the shop at the stadium, or some fast food along the way. So really organising and planning is massive. And the types of snacks you should be eating are, you know, like bananas and other fruits, nuts. You know, you can even have a whole grain sandwich on hand if you're really, you know, hungry. That type of stuff, rather than settling for fried foods or, you know, other foods that aren't very good for you.
Yeah, the easier options, unfortunately. But as you say, it's a lot of planning that goes into that as well. It's just a little bit of diligence to grab some fruit on the way out the door rather than, you know, as you say, grabbing a vending machine meal, which could be anything, and tends to be a lot higher in salt as well, which leads to a whole range of other problems as well. So, yeah, I think planning, as you say, is a really big thing. So at what age do athletes probably need to start being a little bit more diligent about what they're putting into their bodies?
I think the time that they step up their, daily schedule to where they're training every day. I think when your body starts demanding a lot from you energy-wise, and you kind of have that need to recover from things, you definitely need to get a nutrition plan in place just to, you know, make sure your body keeps up with everything and your recovery is quick. And it just, you know, it saves you from, like I said before, injury and illness, and that's just really big with athletes. We don't like sitting on the sidelines ever, and we are kind of one to push ourselves beyond our limits a bit, so we really don't want our nutrition working against us in that sense.
So when players are planning for a tournament, just say they've made a state team or something like that, it's really important the food they start putting into their body. How soon before that tournament do they really need to be diligent? It's not something like you can just stop eating the rubbish foods on the Friday and start eating healthy on the Saturday and you'll be okay. Like, how soon before then do you really need to start planning for that?
I'd say, like, as soon as you make a team and you've got a goal, I would start then. Because really, you want to be in the best physical shape. You want to be able to get the most out of each training. You definitely don't want to be going into those tournaments injured. I've definitely championships with niggling injuries, and it's just it hits you pretty hard, your confidence and stuff. So you want to give yourself the best chance. So I'd say as soon as you make a team, really clean up your diet, make sure you're getting enough food every day, and make sure it's from whole sources, like a lot of veggies, and you know, fruit and whole grain products. So I'd do it as soon as possible. And then leading into a tournament and into games, a few days before, I used to really kind of carb load, so I'd get a lot of pasta and all that into me just so I had, you know, adequate stores when it came to the event that I was playing in.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really valuable as well, is knowing what to eat and when you can. I mean, there are some things that everyone gets a little bit funny when they say, oh, you shouldn't eat too much pasta and things like that. But if you've got something fairly significant coming up, you may need those energy stores.
Yeah.
So in terms of eating before games and things like that, how soon is too soon before a game? I mean, some people sort of say, hey, don't eat 4 hours before a game. Some are still snacking on lollies throughout and things like that. Is there any sort of rule in place in terms of preparing for a game?
I think it's all just a personal thing. So I think you need to work out pretty quickly the right kind of timing for yourself and how you perform. So I, throughout college, my whole team would get together 4 hours before a game and would have a big pasta meal.
Yep.
And you know, we'd all sit around and eat pasta with a lean protein, usually chicken, and some bread and everything, and that got us through really well. Like I found that was my favourite routine that I continued to stick with throughout my career.
Yep.
Some people prefer a lighter meal 2 hours before. I'd always have like a banana beforehand. I never really liked eating lollies during the game. It just wasn't kind of my thing, but I do know lots of athletes that like to come and, you know, get on the bench and eat some lollies throughout the game. So I think really you just got to find what works for you, and if you're finding you're really lacking energy in the game, you've got to look at your diet, and if you're not eating enough or you're not eating close enough to your game, you know, you play around with it a bit and just find the right mix.
Yep, and I think, I mean, you touch on a great point there. It's really easy to go the other way and not eat enough foods. We talk about players overcompensating and eating too much, but it's just as dangerous to not eat enough food, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Well, that's when you get fatigued, and that's when injury can occur and illness. So, yeah, that's why it is important for athletes to actually be very switched on with their diet. It'd be easy for people just to go, oh, I'm just tired today and not really look into it, but you've really got to look at what you're eating, because it can be a big issue.
Yeah, definitely. So what are the best foods and drinks, I suppose, to aid with recovery after a game? So, I mean, you think back to the pre-season tournament days, which were normally in summer. You may have played two or three games a day, 40-odd degree heat. How do they back up and recover from that?
Well, I think it's very important to get some recovery food in as soon as possible, within the first 30 minutes of finishing up your training. They used to think it was just protein that was important, but it's actually a mix of carbohydrate and protein. So I used to have like a banana and some peanut butter. I mean, some people have chocolate milk. I mean, that makes some people very sick. It would make me sick. But I mean, you could have a sandwich, you know, whole grain sandwich or something with some protein, like turkey. It's really just a personal choice, but keeping them good, you know, whole grain foods and like I said before, it doesn't have to be whole grain, it can be these simple sugars, so you could have a peanut butter sandwich or something, and white bread is fine. So yeah, really just a personal choice.
Yeah, definitely. Does it make any difference in regards to what athletes are drinking during the game? I mean, some people are adamant that it has to only be water. Some are really addicted to the high sugar drinks, such as the Gatorades and the Powerades, etc. Does it make a real difference in a game?
I don't think in the game. I think being hydrated is massive, and that's, I probably should have brought that up as one of the biggest issues with athletes' diets, is that a lot of the time we're dehydrated and we don't drink enough water. So definitely, you know, while we're playing and we're sweating a lot, we do lose electrolytes. So that's an issue, and that's where sports drinks can come in really handy. Post-sport, I mean, if you like drinking them during sport, that's good too. Really, it's up to you. Monitor things. If you're drinking too much of it, you'll know about it, because, you know, they can be high in sugar. It's really just something you've got to kind of keep check of and just see what works for you. But I don't think there's any set rule. You can't have sports drinks, or you can only have water. Yeah.
No, definitely. Any last advice to players that might be travelling around all over the place playing games? I mean, you would have gone through the years of like weekend camps and things like that as well with your state teams growing up, and even through your international experience. Any advice for players that you can give them to sort of help them with their diet along the way as well?
I think my main advice I would give would be actually to be very aware of your diet, to learn as much as you can. You can do a lot of your own self-study, but I think I wish at a younger age I had paid more attention to my diet. It can help performance so much. Stay hydrated, have a balanced diet, but eat a lot of nutritious food, and be prepared when it comes to snacking, because we are on the road a lot, and you don't want to get caught out without any good nutritious snacks.
Yep, excellent. Hannah, thanks very much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time with this as well. It's great insight for the athletes as well as the coaches, who can put a little bit more time and knowledge into the athletes as well. So really appreciate your time with this.
Great. Thanks, Hannah.